Welcome to the Flourishing After Addiction podcast. I'm Carl Eric Fisher, an addiction psychiatrist and bioethicist at Columbia University and a person in recovery. In this podcast, I'm doing deep dive interviews with people working toward flourishing after addiction, seeking out fresh perspectives about key topics in psychiatry, philosophy, and authentic well-being. That means people like scientific researchers, artists and writers, spiritual teachers, and more. My goal is to seek out practical lessons that can help us all work toward thriving and well-being, while still respecting the complexities and nuance of addiction and recovery. If that sounds interesting to you, check out my Substack newsletter about addiction and recovery. You can find that just by heading over to my website, carlericfisher.com, or look me up on Substack, Rat Park with Carl Eric Fisher. For today, I'm really excited to be speaking to the excellent writer and my new friend, Laura Cathcart Robbins. Laura is the best-selling author of the Atria and Simon & Schuster memoir, Stash, My Life in Hiding. She hosts the popular podcast, The Only One in the Room, and she's been active for many years as a speaker. She also has experience as a school trustee, and she created the Buckley School's nationally recognized Committee on Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, and Justice. She's written quite a bit on the subjects of race, recovery, and divorce. She's a TEDx speaker, a Moth Story Slam winner. She's done a lot of fantastic work, which we will talk about more on this show. We talk about a ton, her personal experience, her childhood, connection between early experiences with disconnection and addiction, her experience with doctors, bending truths, doctor shopping, getting refills, and then writing a book about recovery, questions of identity, inner work, her experience in treatment, and much, 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 much more. Her current recovery framework today, how she works her own recovery. And it's just a great one. Very practical, very personal, and I think you'll enjoy. So I hope you'll enjoy my conversation with Laura Cathcart Robbins. All right, Laura, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I feel like I could just talk to you forever all the time, so I'm excited.
Likewise. Feeling is mutual. It was great to be on that panel together, and then
yes,
I feel like I made a new addiction writer friend, so that's always a gift.
Thank you.
So I usually like to start off just asking people to tell their addiction story. What happened? How'd you get into recovery? What was your experience of addiction in all of its different forms?
So yeah, it's a big story, but I'll just kind of focus in on the end of my active addiction, which I live in Los Angeles, and I was in a high profile Hollywood marriage at the time. We have two children, and they were little at that time. And I think I talk about this a lot. I think that the scaffolding for my addiction was the separation from my authentic self that started when I was a little kid. And that sounds almost philosophical, but I think the reality was that because my stepfather was rubbed the wrong way by everything I did when I was myself. So I was like this little kid who was really inquisitive and loud and in your face and wanted to stay up late and kind of buck all the rules. And we lived in Cambridge, and he was very kind of strict New England Episcopalian. Nothing wrong with Episcopalians, but this is the background he came from. And he had a set of beliefs about what children should be and shouldn't be. And I mainly fell into the shouldn't be category. So what I learned to do growing up was edit myself. And kind of, I use the word that is the title of my book, Stash, those pieces away of myself that displeased him, so that our house would be calmer, because it was a violent home. The violence, physical violence, didn't fall on me, but it fell on my mother, who I was and am very close to. So it was to protect the energy in the house, to protect my mom. I made myself different. And that's how I survived my childhood. I also grew up Black and white spaces. I went to really wonderful independent schools. They called them private schools then. And I was not only the only Black one in my school for a while, I was always the only Black one in my class when I was growing up until high school, but I was also the only poor one. And that was a big juxtaposition as well. There was my white friends who had two-story homes and backyards and once a week housekeepers and pantries, which were like little stores for me. I'd never seen a pantry. And we lived, the three of us, my stepfather, my mother, and I, in a one-bedroom apartment. I got the bedroom and they slept in the living room. So there were all these things that made me different than my peers. And I was also different at home because I didn't feel like I could be myself at home. I was different than what he wanted at home. All that to say, that continued through my young adult life. I ended up dropping out of high school, never finishing, never going to college. I'm never getting an equivalency. And I lied about all of it. Like I lied about my upbringing. I lied about my happy home. I lied about finishing high school and going to college, so that by the time I get to the year that I'm talking about, most of these people that I knew that were in my life had a completely different picture of me. This woman who grown up with this kind of idyllic childhood in Cambridge, Mass, who had gone to college and finished high school. I had, in fact, started a business that I had a public relations company that actually was successful when I was in my late 20s, early 30s. And so there, that seemed to be validation for the life that I had professed for the person that I professed to be. This all came to a head really in the year 2008, so a little over 15 years ago. And I had been prescribed Ambien for insomnia years before that. And I found it to be like the magic pill that I needed. It helped with a lot more than sleep for me. It really reset my system. I felt energetic. I felt like I could be fun. I felt like all these roles that I had taken on, all these things that were expected of me, I could finally do with ease. And that was lovely. But I started to build up a tolerance for it. And then I needed more and more. And as the years went on, by the year 2008, I was taking up to 10 a day. Mm-hmm. And was the PTA president and had just been asked to join the board at my kid's school and had asked for a divorce because I was so desperately unhappy and I thought maybe it was the marriage. I actually prayed it was the marriage because if it was the marriage, I didn't have to give up the pills and I wouldn't need the pills in the same way either because then the unhappiness would be gone. So I wouldn't need to treat what was going on the same way. And I didn't like to. I ended up washing the pills down with booze every night at the end because I needed to boost the effect. And that was the best way that I discovered to do it. I'm not someone who really likes alcohol. I don't like the taste. I was never really a big drinker. I was a social drinker through my 20s. But this combination of booze and pills really seemed to do the trick. But it made it difficult for me to engage with people because either I was in severe withdrawal and that looked like I was in severe withdrawal, or I was a little bit loaded and people were starting to wonder, like, are you okay? Is anything going on? And I blamed it conveniently on my divorce that, oh, well, of course, she's a little depressed. She's out of it. She's sleeping all day because... And that explained a lot of my absences, that explained my cancellations when I would cancel on friends. But yeah, eventually I filed for divorce in March of 2008. That's not true. I didn't file then. I asked for a divorce. Then I ended up filing a couple months later. And in July of 2008, that's when I was taking the up to 10 Ambien, washing them down with booze. Soon to be ex-husband is traveling for work. So he was not around a lot, wasn't like ringside to what was happening. And I was really able, I was very performative, high functioning, I think they call it. I was able to pull it together when I needed to so that for brief periods of time, but I looked normal for those brief periods of time. Mm-hmm. So I really did fool a lot of people, but the bottom that I experienced, the kind of moment of clarity, was when I had taken everything that I had in the pill bottle and I washed it down with booze and I had taken Benadryl, which I also found boosted it. and it didn't work. So I was at that jumping off place that's talked about in the literature, the 12-step program I go to, where I couldn't get loaded and I couldn't be sober because sober was excruciating. And now loaded was out of my reach. So yeah, sober was unbearable. So I went to treatment and it was the hardest thing I've ever done. I left my children, who are the only reason I got sober, was for them. I didn't want them to bury me or end up visiting me in institutions for the rest of their life. And that's where I was heading.
That's great. Yeah. I mean, there's so much there. I almost want you to just keep on going. I could listen to this all day. It's like a gripping story, even though I've already read the book and it's a great book and we'll get into the writing process too, but I'm glad we got to the Ambien, of course.
Yeah.
There's a lot of parallels in our two stories about doctor shopping, the experience of prescriptions, having privileged access to prescriptions, but then also that sort of precarity and the threat of it being cut off and the sort of manipulative dance of how you present yourself to doctors to try to get what you think you need. That was really striking to me on rereading the book. And yeah, I'm wondering if you could talk about that, because that also seems to be, it's kind of like on a parallel track with this other theme that you started off with about being in connection with your authentic self versus maintaining this facade, trying to be normal, trying to hold on to the marriage, trying to hold on to the social roles, just the face that you're putting out into the world. When your substance of choice is a prescription drug, it gets really tricky. Yeah.
Yeah. And just to bear in mind, this was 2008. I had a lot more leeway with how I could manipulate the system and maneuver within it. I think today it's a lot more difficult. Mm-hmm. Because everything was on those prescription pads, that was not just like a regular pad, and computers talk to each other about everything, and people are bringing doctors up on charges when they overprescribe. This was not frequently happening in the year 2008, not the way that it is now. And so what I found is that I present really well, and this has been true for me for my entire life. So when I go in, even if I'm expecting a bad result, like with a teacher at school, and I'm being called in, and I'm sure that they've seen through it, right? And this woman is not making it, and blah, or this child is not making it. And then I come in with my kind of sunny disposition, and I won't say charm because it's not an effort, but maybe there is some charm there. And usually it turns around in the moment where people are like, okay, we do see this, but this is who you are, clearly. So we're going to give you this chance. And I've always kind of had that. And I think I started using it when I was a young adult. I don't remember if I used it when I was a kid. I don't think I did, but that could not be true. But to manipulate adults that I'm scared of, right, who are in a position of authority, so that, and there's something at stake. Like, the doctor is such a good example, because my dad's a doctor. My dad is 39 years sober, but he's also a physician. He's been HIV AIDS doctor since 1987. And so I grew up. So this is not my stepfather, but my father, they were divorced. My parents were divorced, and my father always lived in another state from me. But I would visit him, and I had these really wonderful experiences with him. And I would sit in his office and see patients come in, and the respect with which they regarded him. People would never call him by his first name or even just Mr. It was always doctor or Dr. Cathcart. So that reverence, I learned that reverence growing up. I watched it. And so when I went into a doctor's office, one, I had that respect for the doctor, but I was also a little intimidated. That's not true. I was intimidated, and I still am. At times when I go into a doctor's office, I go in with this resolve, and then somewhere in the middle of the visit, I usually lose it and try to kind of make them like me, or like make them think I'm a good patient, or make them think that I, in the case of the doctor shopping in 2008, make them think I'm not an addict. Clearly, this woman has so much on her plate. She's getting divorced. She has two little kids. The role exhaustion is on fleek. So she needs these pills to get some sleep. that's super harmless, right? That's really harmless. We could prescribe these pills again. Yeah, it's a little early, but she lost them, or her house was being tinted, and that's totally understandable. And so each time I presented myself and kind of put myself in their hands, for a long time, I was able to present something to them that looked worthy of whatever it was that I was asking for. And I was really careful. Like, I knew that if they caught desperation, right? If this wasn't a casual visit where I was saying, oh, by the way, at the end, do you think you can refill this for me? If I came in with that on my mind, they would smell it. Right. And then there would be a conversation that I didn't want to have because it might lead me to either getting less pills or no pills at all. Mm-hmm. So there was I've never been an actor. I've been on stages now, but just to speak, but I've never like been on a stage and given a performance, but I was giving performances. I was auditioning. I was practicing. I was going in there and I was nailing it, nailing the performance every time, skipping to the parking lot with that refilled prescription in my hand. Right. Yes, I did it again.
Right. Maybe you were intimidated or not intimidated, and maybe that's not the core of it all, but it makes me think of the code. Like, you knew the code. You had been inducted into how to comport yourself and what the rules were. And I got that more directly in a certain way. But you also had experiences with different codes and code switching and other contexts too.
Yes. Yeah. And I mean, there's a lot of that. And because all my doctors, are they still? Yeah, all my doctors are white. All my doctors are white men, actually, still now. And there is, I mean, I know I can feel it when I walk in. There are just certain things that I won't say. There are certain inflections that my voice will be absent from the way that I speak. And I mean, like, I wouldn't have it with you because I feel very comfortable with you, but there's a level at which I feel, I don't know how to articulate this actually, but there's a way that I like to be viewed in certain circles. And the coming into a doctor's office in particular, I want them to think that I don't need anything. I want that checklist that tells me that I've hit all the marks and I'm in good health and blah, blah, blah. And I don't want to appear as less than. Maybe it's less than. And in my mind, being Black isn't less than. And I'll just say this really quickly because I think it's important. One of the things that my stepfather, my mother, and my father did for me was to always instill in me, show me, model for me that Black was beautiful, the thing to be. So I didn't grow up ever wanting to be white or thinking that things might be better if I were. And a lot of my peers did. Right next door in Boston, the same age little girls were getting spit on and called the N-word and getting stones thrown at them and telling them, getting the exact opposite messaging that I was getting. So when I go into these white doctor's offices, I don't think that I'm less than for being Black, but I think there's an awareness that they could view me like that. And so I want to be above that. I want to defy the stereotype and come in as something that maybe they can't put their finger on, but it's still very pleasant.
What a beautiful gift they gave you. My goodness. That must have been a hard gift to give you.
Man.
Especially amid what sounds like a challenging family dynamic.
Yeah.
And it relates to, and I wanted to talk about the writing process too, and because this will be woven throughout your personal story, of course. It really struck me where you wrote early in the book that you had scoured bookstores for memoirs during the time that you were exploring recovery. You were desperate for stories like mine written by women who look like me, and I found none. And yes. I wrote Stash to make sure that the next person going through any of that or all of that finds themselves in the pages of a book. So we were talking a little bit earlier too about just the writing process, how hard it was for you and all the rest. So maybe talk to us a little more about how those questions of identity play into the writing process, your mission for writing, and what was it actually like for you to go out and write this book?
So writing the book, I mean, honestly, Stash is not the book I wanted to write. I love memoir. I love it. I've always read it. I am at my happiest. Like when I was a little kid, I would read the comics in the newspaper and the Sunday paper, and I would read the obituaries because they were stories, not because I was morbid, but I mean, maybe that is a little morbid, but I just love the stories that there was always a picture and then a story of how they lived their life and who they left behind. And I just ate them up. I thought they were beautiful. And I've always loved, I read biographies and autobiographies, and memoir came a little bit later for me when I was like 10 or 11, but I love memoir. And I have a life that I think has several parts that could be written about. And I didn't want to write about the addiction. That was not the thing that I wanted to write. And so I pitched different things. And I took a bunch of writing classes to kind of hone the craft. And all of my writing teachers all told me the same thing. It's like, oh, this bit here, this 2008, that's the story. And I'm like, oh, that's not the story, but that's the story. That's what I kept hearing. So it was actually Holly Whitaker that read some pages, 30 pages to be exact, of that story and freaked out. And when she loves something, right, it's just like you can feel it through the phone. There's just this burst of warmth. And she's like, you've got to write this. You must write this. And then sent them to her agent. And then I got signed with her agent like the next week, which was mind-blowing because I had been trying for a couple of years and Bupkas, and now one referral, and I have an agent who's still my agent, who's amazing. And that was November of 2020. And she asked me how quickly I could write the book. And I was like, I'll get started right now. And I wrote it in 6 months.
Oh, wow.
The actual process for writing it wasn't what I typically hear for people who are writing a first book, because it was rather quick, but it was also the pandemic. And so I wrote from 11 to 7, 5 days a week, with taking like a half hour break for lunch, which I sometimes didn't take. I would eat at my desk if I was like in a flow. I did. I was in a group text doing 100 pushups a day at the time. So I would write for it, and then my Apple Watch would tell me time to stand up, and I would do 10 pushups and then get back to the page. Nice. I had really good upper body strength for a while. So, and that was for me to write about that year. It was, I understood how important it was for me. If I was going to write about it, I needed to go back there and feel those feelings again and see the things in my mind's eye that I saw then, like, I needed to be able to picture my medicine cabinet and like the order of the pills that were inside and how I had like decoy bottles. Like I needed to be able to see all of those and remember all the places I hid my pills. And I have the good fortune to be a journaler. So I had a lot of that documented and I was able to refer back to those journals. But a lot of it was inner work where I would always meditate before I started the day of writing and really try to settle my nervous system. I don't know if this happens to you, Carl, but when I'm writing, even when I'm not writing, my mind is still writing. And sometimes it writes to a point where I have to just like get something down on the page and then I can go back to whatever I'm doing. And so the meditation was a way to quiet that and not have it just going so I could start off the day like settled and not, I don't know what the word is, but not agitated, because I wasn't agitated, but I'd be really just anxious, I guess, to get something on the page. And so that was really the process for me. I did that for 6 months and then turned in the first draft. And then she sold it a few months later at auction, which was something I didn't know existed until publishing houses were bidding against each other for it. And then it ended up at Atria, Simon & Schuster.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And we're all the better for it. It's a great book. It's really interesting. Lots more to talk about the content. But one other thing that struck me when we were on a panel together is how you reclaimed the label Quitlet. And yes, you used it earlier too, because that's commonly used in a derogatory way, right? Like people will say, oh, that's Quitlet. It's a very gendered kind of criticism too. It's like, yes, oh, it's looked down on this type of thing. And you mentioned how when you Google Quitlet, it looks like a particular type of author and all the rest. So is that true though? Are you actually trying to reclaim Quitlet, like make Quitlet cool again?
Hey, you know what? Yes, if I can. Well, the thing is, this book is an addiction memoir. I think it's a lot more than that, but that's how people view it, as an addiction memoir. It's also a Black woman's story. So those two things by themselves are already limiting. People who don't, I don't need it to read a memoir about addiction. A lot of people think they're bummers, or they're going to be too clinical, or whatever it might be. I don't want to read about addiction. And if they're not of color or Black, they may not want to read a Black woman's story. So whatever I can like link into or be a part of that's going to help push this story out into the world, I'm happy to do that. And Quitlet, which sounds like chiclet, which makes it gendered. And the majority of people in that genre are white and women. However, the term was coined, I think, a year and a half ago by the Washington Post. People have probably used it before, but this was like the first article where they talked about this is a genre and here are the people that are in it. And so it was kind of like a call to anyone who wanted to look at their relationship with alcohol, not necessarily if you're already an addict or if you're already an alcoholic or you already have alcohol use disorder. You can just check out this category if you're thinking about alcohol, right? You're thinking about it. And so that widens the category a lot. So no longer is it a category just for people who are grappling with addiction. It's a category for anyone who wants to look at their relationship with alcohol or drugs, but they don't really talk about that as much. And so if I'm established in that category, I'm going to get a lot more eyes on me than if I'm just on the addiction memoir shelf. So yes, I am trying to make it cool. I am trying to bring in more voices of color to it, because right now when you Google that genre, you will find me, but I am the only Black person you find in that genre. Mm-hmm. And that just blows my mind, Carl. Right. Like, first, I mean, we Black people have been saddled with the label of being addicts forever, right? Like the war on drugs was a war against us. And then if you think like any derogatory term, you've probably like a crack baby, you're associating it with a Black person. And yet there are no Black voices in this category that's geared toward addiction. Mm-hmm. That's just nuts. That doesn't make any sense to me. It can't just be white women and a couple of men, white men. It's got to be more than that. And the thing is that publishers need to know that they can sell that book. That's the thing.
Yeah.
It's not that nobody thinks that Black people don't deal with addiction, but will they buy the book? And you don't know until the book is out there, right? So mine is out there. People are buying it. And to anyone who's listening, if you've already gotten it, thank you so much. If not, then please pick up a copy or listen to the audiobook. But that's the world I'm in, and that's the world I'm trying to evolve.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think at a meaningful level too, the notion of making it about the quitting process or the recovery process means it's not just an account of the most depraved moments or the bottoms. Like, one thing I liked about the book is that there really is a lot of focus on the messy process of getting well. And you mentioned that Augustine Burroughs was an inspiration, yes, which made perfect sense to me. I immediately thought this is a Burroughsian, especially with the way you lingered on treatment and the experience of being in a treatment program. It made me think of Dry, which, by the way, when I was in rehab, it was banned. You were not allowed to read Dry. People,
no.
And that's not true, actually. People were allowed to read Dry, but only after they had been in rehab for 6 weeks. The counselors had this idea that, like, if you read it before then, you would somehow get the idea that you should go, like, engage in some tomfoolery, which, guess what, people were doing anyway.
Yes.
So I really love that part of it, of the book, is that just like the experience in treatment, the struggle with the desire to use again. You were talking earlier about the deception of others or the way you present yourself to others, but there's also the self-deception too, like arguing before the court of myself. So I don't know. What strikes you now? Like, what about that experience of going to treatment should we talk about? Because there's a lot there. I mean, I was attaching to the self-deception part of it, but
yeah. Well, I talk about that a lot. I speak a lot at recovery meetings and or 12-step meetings. And I talk about my time in treatment because I don't hear my experience talked about as often as I hear about people who get to treatment and then finally feel safe and find that in during that time that they're there, that sobriety is their priority. And they come out with kind of this new way of looking at life and this, like I said, a new priority, a new order for their lives. And that was not my experience. I didn't get there and feel safe. I hated being there. I hated it. And the first reason I hated it was because I was away from my children. And that was the longest I'd ever been away from them. And it broke me. The second reason I hated it is because I'm really a snob. I hate sharing a room. I hate sharing a bathroom. I don't like sharing anything, honestly. And to do it with three other women and then a whole group of people, and then to be forced to literally share my experience, to talk in front of these groups when I never talked in front of anyone, I just found it to be quite painful, honestly. And it wasn't like, oh, and 2 weeks in, I loved it. I didn't. I endured it for basically the whole time I was there. And at the very end, and honestly, this wasn't, my editor really wanted this experience in the book. I wouldn't have put it in because it wasn't as profound for me as it sounds in the book. But when I was seen at the end by the woman who gave me my meds, this is the end of my time in treatment, and she saw this light come on in me. And that was kind of startling for me because I didn't know that I'd come in with my lights off. And so for her to be really taken by this shift in me, that was a moment, but it wasn't as profound as it, to me, it didn't feel like that at the moment. But I put it in the book because they wanted it. They wanted a moment at the end of treatment that felt like I was ready to go out into the world. But I didn't feel like I was ready to go out into the world. When I left, in fact, I was trying to call in a refill to pick up an Ambien refill to pick up on my way home. That was going to be my plan for getting out into the world. Very excited to have like a whole clean system that hadn't had anything in it for 30 days so that I could once again feel the thing that I had been chasing all that time. That was elusive to me at the end. I couldn't get that clean high that I had gotten in the beginning. And I thought that I could after treatment. And yeah, so that's what I was looking forward to. I was looking forward to seeing my kids in that clean high when I left. And yeah, there is nothing in me that wants to go back and visit or to like, I just didn't like it. I didn't enjoy it, but I did meet Scott there. Hmm. So that's another thing.
Yeah.
That was the good
thing. I want to talk about that. But for the people who don't know your story, you got to tell us what happened next. So you're leaving Trita.
Refill. Yeah. So I met this guy the hour I checked into treatment, and he and I became friends while I was there. I really credit him still for saving my life. I don't think I would have stayed there if it weren't for him. And we weren't what people think of when they think of a rehab hookup, but there was definitely an attraction there between the two of us. And there were a couple of kisses exchanged. But the reality of our respective situations, he had four DUIs. He was facing prison and the loss of his time, custody of his girls. I was in the middle of, or the end of a divorce, and I was facing looking at the possibility of not being able to stay in my kids' lives. Those things weighed heavier on us than the attraction that we felt for each other. But we ended up leaving together. And I had arranged for this refill that I could pick up in Wickenburg, which is where I was. That's Arizona. There are like 10 things in Wickenburg, or there were then, and one of them was a CVS. And I called it into that CVS, and we were leaving. I had a town car pick us up to take us to the airport. He was going to fly back to Utah. I'm flying back to LA. And I planned to just pick it up on the way, but I didn't know how to do that all of a sudden with him in the car with me. And all of my planning hadn't accounted for the fact that Scott would probably want to come in with me if I was stopping at a drugstore. And I didn't know what to do. And we just passed it. Like, the driver kept driving because I didn't tell him to stop because I couldn't think of a reason that would get me in there. And Scott was oblivious. He had no idea. He was just chattering away. And I felt like an anvil fell on my head. Like, I was flattened by this. And at the same time, after we got a few more miles down the road to the Starbucks, which we were both craving because we were denied caffeine and sugar for 30 days, which I thought was particularly cruel. Like, I'm already detoxing. There was just like a modicum of something in me that was proud of me for leaving it back there. Everything else in me was like, figure out how to go get it. And then already my mind was shifting. You'll just get it transferred to LA. That's all. It's not a big deal. We'll just call when we land, get it transferred. You can pick it up tomorrow instead of having it tonight. But I never did that. I never did that. I actually haven't had a drink or a drug. Oh, that's not true. I was prescribed Vicodin after a surgery, which I took as prescribed for 2 days, and then I got rid of it. So I've had a drug since then. I did not like it, Carl. Mm. I thought I was going to love it. I was really looking forward to it. I was like, ah, yes, it's a freebie and no one can say anything. And I hated it. Mm. I hated having it in me. I couldn't wait to not have that feeling. And it shocked me. This is like 8 years later, eight years after I got sober. So yeah, so that's, I've been, as they say, clean and sober since August 14th, 2008.
Wow. Yeah. A huge achievement and the riveting story of passing by the CVS. But, you know, you mentioned the relationship with Scott and the listener might be wondering, like, there's rules in rehab against relationships. Like you said, on the face of it, both of you had big problems in your life. There's even like a casual rule that some people say you shouldn't get in a relationship for the first year of recovery. They probably hammered on that at some point. Yes. And here you are, like, on paper, this is the worst idea ever.
The worst. Yes.
And still it worked out for you. So what do you, what do you have to say for that? Like, would you recommend other people who just give it a try and just go ahead and date in the first year of recovery, or what? You just got lucky? Well, what's the story here?
I think there were a few things working in our favor. One was that we were both, had been married and divorced and had children. And we're a little bit later in life. I was 44 when I got out of treatment. And that really kind of diminished the sense of urgency that I think is just such a big part of most new relationships, that there is like, I got to see that Jonesy feeling. So I think that because we were where we were, even without addiction or alcoholism or whatever it is, I think we would have had a little bit of space from that drive, that Jonesy thing that comes with it, like I said. But that's supposition. I don't know if that's true. The reality was that I was terrified of having anything interfere with my divorce because I didn't want it to impact custody of my kids. And I think it's important that I also say this. My ex-husband, he never threatened me with that. He never said, you're not going to be able to see them. This was in my mind, in my divorce attorney's mind, that I was up against the possibility of this. But I was terrified at that time, and I really wanted to stay in my kids' lives, and I wanted to do that more than I wanted to be with Scott. So what we did was we set a batting order, kind of right at the beginning, probably like 3 or 4 months in, that we were dating, which came right after treatment. He moved from Utah to LA in like October of 2008. And he went to a sober living. He didn't come to live with me or anything. And I rarely saw him. I only saw him at meetings. That's how we did it those first few months. But we decided our recovery, like our respective recoveries, had to come first, whatever that looked like. Second were our families, our children, our parents. Both his parents were alive at that time. They're not now. But they had to come second. And then everything else, including each other, came third. And we figured if we kept that order that we could stay in each other's lives. So like, for instance, if my kids wanted to snuggle and watch TV, but I had a meeting to go to, I had to go to the meeting. And then I got to snuggle with my kids. But if Scott wanted to see me and my kids wanted to snuggle, my kids came first. So I kept that order, recovery before kids, before him. And that meant I didn't see him a lot. And it meant I almost never saw him socially. But that was okay. Mm. We talked on the phone at night after my kids went to bed.
Yeah, but you didn't get like the Jonesy feeling of waiting for his text or getting stressed out when he left you on read or anything? Because that, I mean, that's part of like the intrigue. And before you were talking about manipulating adults to get what you need, and that's the dynamic that comes up in a lot of
these. Yeah, well, we weren't texting. Smartphones had maybe just come out. So we like called each other. I think there were like a couple of texts. I didn't really know how to text in 2008.
Oh, wow.
He was a little frustrated with me in the beginning. I'm sure there were Jonesy spots. I'm sure, but it wasn't my driver. I wasn't ruled by it. I felt very secure with him. And I also felt very okay if I didn't have him. What was important to me were my kids. Hmm. And because the only way I could stay in my kids' life was my recovery, then my recovery became paramount to everything. And so he was wonderful. Like when, after the divorce, when I started spending weekends without them, we would go to movies. We would go to meetings together. He would fill those hours for me where I was sobbing through the days because I just didn't know how I was going to get through these weekends without my kids. And he was so great. He really helped. And there were absolutely times where I didn't get a call back from him and I worried because we were both new in recovery and I didn't know what was happening. And that was another worry of mine. But I didn't worry about whether or not he was in the relationship that we were building. And we built it for 6 years. So I was 6 years sober when we decided to move in together. And up until that point, we had dated. I very lightly introduced him to my children. They weren't really aware of him that first couple years. They knew that I have a friend named Scott, but he didn't come over for dinner. We didn't go do things with him. Around that 6 year, we took our kids on a trip, his girls, my boys, and we took them to Arizona to a water park, which is really funny, for 3 days. And we had like kind of this bonding weekend. And so like his girls have grown up with my boys, like cousins now. But we really were patient with the relationship. And there was something in me that I had never had in a relationship, which was that just like that subtleness about this, it could be a relationship that works out, but it could also be one that doesn't. And I really felt like I was okay either way because I had what I needed, which was my recovery and my kids.
Well, it sounds like you built the foundations of a really beautiful recovery, which we can all see today. Mm. And so I wanted to ask about that. Like what you mentioned your recovery framework is 12 steps, but tell us a little more about how you work your recovery today. How do you make sense of your recovery? What are the components? Like what is recovery for you now?
So I really think my recovery for me is about choices. Was an active addiction. I didn't have a lot of choices. I had to do what was demanded of me by the addiction. It's like, oh no, you may want to go do this, but you're going to the doctor now and getting that refill fix, or you're going by the liquor store and risking running into somebody because we need booze to wash that down with now. And so I felt like I didn't have a lot of choice. And obviously now 15 plus years later, I'm not called, this isn't obvious. Where I am in my recovery, I'm not called to use or drink. I don't ever think about, oh, this would be better if I could have a drink, or this would be better if I could take a pill. I just don't. I don't think about that on a day-to-day ever. I'm really clear on what would happen to me with my history, how progressed I was, how ill I was if I did. And I'm not interested in that. I'm not interested in that at all. So I don't get called to do that, but I do get called to do things that jeopardize my balance. And when my balance is off, there's something in the literature of my program that says, whenever we are disturbed, no matter what the cause, our first need is to quiet that disturbance. And I know exactly what quiet disturbance is. I know how long it takes to hit my bloodstream. I know what I need to wash it down with. I know, you know, how quickly I'll fall asleep afterward. I know how to quiet a disturbance. So my goal in recovery is not to get disturbed very often. And the way that I do that is I try to live a really balanced life. So the role exhaustion that I was experiencing in addiction, I don't have that in my life. I don't wear a lot of hats. I don't say yes to a lot. I really understand what's good for me and what isn't. I've become plant-based in recovery. I figured out that's good for me. Obviously, I don't drink, so that's good for me. I meditate, which is something that was not on my radar before recovery, and I didn't think that I would like it. I do this thing that probably other people would call prayer. I don't know that I call it that because I don't believe in a deity, but I do this thing where I kind of state my intentions for the day. And I do that either before or after my meditation. And I feel like I'm stating it to something, like, and I don't want to get too far into this, but I feel like there's something out there. I just don't think it's a deity. For me, I don't believe that. But I feel like there's an energy that I can access. That is, when I can access it, when I've cleared everything away, is really good for me. And when I'm tapped into that, I make better choices, like not to punish Scott when I've been slighted with silent scorn. Right? Or because that's a big go-to for me. And I think that comes from my childhood when I would just get quiet when things got loud or violent, or I would get quiet and give them nothing. I write about that in my book. And I still do that. I'm not as often anymore, but when I'm able to make the choice in that moment that I feel slighted or misunderstood to not drop into silent scorn, that's my recovery working. That's what I feel my recovery is. And I sponsor women in recovery, which means I take them through the program and the steps of the program. And then I'm also just there to help them kind of sort out stuff as it comes up. I go to 3 to 4 meetings a week, usually one that I'm asked to speak at. And the other one of them is my home group. One of them we have at our house. So I'm kind of surrounded by recovery. I've had a recovery meeting in my house, a big book study, we call it, since I was a year sober. So for the last 14 plus years, every Saturday, people have gathered in our home to kind of study this work and talk about it. So in a lot of respects, I'm deeply entrenched in my recovery, but it's not my life. My life is why I do the recovery, because I have a big life outside of it.
Wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's wonderful that you started a meeting in your home too.
Yeah.
I just wondering, was this like a local network thing? Like you knew people from treatment, or you and Scott knew some people, or what? How did that one work out?
It started because the textbook for this 12-step program was written by this old white guy in the 30s, and I could not connect. And I was really resentful about the fact that this was the text for my recovery. And as I understood more that this was a life I'd rather live than the life I was living before, I really wanted to understand it better. Like, why are all these people doing this? Why is this the way that we do things? Why are these the things that are said? So Scott and I started reading it to each other. And we did that a lot. We did that for years, actually, outside of that meeting. But his daughters were here visiting for the summer, and we could have taken them to a meeting, but they were 4 and 8, and it just wouldn't have been fun. So we decided to have a meeting by just reading the book to each other. And then we invited our sponsors to join us. So there were 4 of us. And then one of the women I sponsored said she wanted to join. So that's how it grew. And we really just read the book and talk about it and try to figure things out and make sense of stuff that doesn't make sense and find ourselves in places where we are. I find myself in that book a lot. I don't find myself in all of it, but there are a lot of places that I didn't see at first where I'm like, oh my God, that's me. Mm-hmm. Like I drank like that. I used like that. I obsessed like that. And so I'll find these things that were just, they were unavailable to me prior to studying it. So now it's probably about 20 people.
Give
and take 20 people.
Yeah. And I mean, the thing I find so inspiring about that is that you created your own space where you could investigate this sort of troubled and troubling historical artifact that's never been revised, that a lot of people struggle with. And a lot of people just bounce off, kind of like the UV rays bouncing off the sunscreen or something. I don't know. And something about it made you inquisitive enough to create this space where you would investigate in a different way. Not a lot of people would do that. I don't hear a lot of stories of people making their own meetings, arranging for their own meetings to fill a need like that. So it's a really resourceful kind of story.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I am curious, and I don't want to have contempt prior to investigation. So we decided to investigate. But the investigation has really paid off for me. I feel more solid in my recovery every time I read and discuss. And it's not like the book is magic and it makes me feel a certain way, but just the process of, you know, with other like-minded people, like-minded in that we're all seeking recovery. Just sometimes it's a big debate, not heated, but people fall on different sides of certain issues. And we get to talk about that in a way that we don't in meetings that are in the directory, the meetings that I go to. Mm-hmm. So thank you. Thank you for that. I appreciate that.
Yeah. That's interesting. It's cool. I'm going to chew on that one. Laura, I'm conscious of the time that our time is running short. I want to thank you for this beautiful book and all the work that you do. In a second, I'll ask if you can just tell us where people can find you and other things. But even before we get to that, I'm wondering if you have any parting words or requests of the audience or final words of wisdom. Anything come to mind?
I think this year that's passed, so it's almost a year since Dash, My Life in Hiding was launched. And I thought a lot of the people who read it would identify with me, but most of the comments I get are from people who are dealing with someone like me, like a daughter of, a husband of, a parent of. And the questions are always kind of the same, which is, what do I do? What was helpful for you? Or what could I have said to you when you were there that would have helped when I was at the bottom eating pills and washing them down with booze with my kids in the next room? And what I've been finding, I've been trying to figure out, because I want to answer people truthfully. And I think the most helpful thing were the people who gave me the dignity of my own experience. I don't think anybody could have told me anything. I don't think any emotional plea would have worked permanently. Certainly it would have made me feel bad. And I would have tried to change if I felt an emotional connection, if I felt guilty, if I felt ashamed, which I did a lot. But there were a couple people who let me know they were there and didn't try to interfere with my experience. And I know that's the hardest thing to do. I've had to do it myself. But that was the most helpful thing, was to allow me the dignity of my experience. And that can be, I could have died. And that's just the reality of that. I didn't, but I could have. And for the people, I think, who have that experience and find their way to some type of recovery, that recovery, I think, has a better chance of sticking than if they're forced into it or intervened on. This is what I think from my experience. So that's probably what I would leave with people.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Yeah. I mean, it sounds, what I'm hearing is the tension between being present and loving and also holding this seemingly mm-hmm. incompatible thing, which is the dignity yes. of one's own experience. And I do think that's possible. And even in some of the most compassionate and even quasi-interventionist models, like Kraft is the form of psychotherapy for family members, is not opposed to that idea, right? Is that mm-hmm. sometimes you have to allow the natural consequences to occur with yeah. discretion, with thoughtfulness, often with help, but yeah. ultimately to give people the dignity of their own experience. I like that.
Yeah.
Laura, thank you so much for this. Thank you again for your work. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of folks wondering where they can find more of you. So where are those places?
The easiest place to find everything is my website. And I'll spell it for you because no one ever knows what my name is.
That makes sense.
And it's Laura, L-A-U-R-A, and then Cathcart, which is C-A-T-H-C-A-R-T, and Robbins, R-O-B-B-I-N-S. So it's LauraCathcartRobbins.com. I'm also at Laura Cathcart Robbins on Instagram. That will take you to my site as well. But those are the easiest places to find the book, to find talks, to find events. Maybe I'm coming to a city near you. Not near you, Carl, unfortunately yet, but someday. So yeah, that's the easiest place to find me.
Okay, great. Well, and I'll definitely link to that in the show notes as well and send that out to folks. So keep an eye out. And Laura, thank you so much for being here and having this conversation. It's always a real joy and I'm grateful for the work you do.
Oh, thank you so much.
That's my interview with Laura Cathcart Robbins. I hope you enjoyed it. I'll link to a few things in the show notes, namely her book, but also her podcast and all of her wonderful work. And you can look that up on Substack, Rat Park with Carl Eric Fisher, or just find me on my website, carlericfisher.com. If you're not already on the list, when you sign up for the email list, you immediately get a free guide I made about the many paths to recovery. And of course, stay up to date with episodes, show notes, other writings. Once again, you can find all that at carlericfisher.com. And finally, by way of housekeeping, I just wanted to say I am really enjoying working on Substack, and your paid subscriptions are such a powerful vote of confidence, and truly even more so, your comments and feedback and correspondence. Thank you so much for being a part of it, whether you're posting on the website or just writing into me individually. My main goal in switching over to Substack was to connect. I want to hear from you, so please do be in touch. Of course, if you're already a part of that Substack group, please share. You can send the link or send this podcast episode. And once again, that's all Rat Park with Carl Eric Fisher. So thanks so much for listening. Thanks so much for being here. And I'll talk to you again soon. This podcast is for general informational purposes only. It isn't medical or clinical advice. The content is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you have questions, please consult a medical professional. Conflicts of interest are an important topic in addiction and recovery. For now, these conversations are just me bringing them to you ad-free for their own sake. I do have a list of disclosures about my work and my positions on my website, which I will keep updated.